call to order this meeting of the Ways and Means Committee. We do have a quorum. Members, we have a relatively light agenda today. We're just funding two-thirds of state government, that's all. Our first item is approval of the minutes. Representative Robbins, have you had a chance to review the minutes?
I have, Mr. Chair, and I move the approval of the minutes. Thank you.
Representative Robbins move approval of our minutes from April 12, 2025. Discussion to the motion. Seeing no discussion, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed say no. Motion prevails and the minutes are approved. And I may have said April 12th, I meant April 28th. Those were the minutes we just approved, the minutes from April 28th. The first bill on our agenda today is House File 2434, the Human Services Finance Bill. And as Chairs Schumacher and Knorr make their way to the front of the room, I will ask Ms. Adrians what the target was for this committee and whether the bill is in compliance with the target.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. The Human Services Finance Committee received a target that was $300 million below the base that was established in the February forecast for fiscal years 26 and 27. And the target for the TAILS for fiscal years 28 and 29 was $1 billion below the forecast base that was established in February. And this bill does reconcile with those numbers, Mr. Chair.
All right, and Chair Schumacher, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I would move that House File 2434 be referred to the General Register.
Chair Schumacher moves that House File 2434 be recommended to be placed on the General Register. Chair Schumacher, you may describe your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and we do have an A5 amendment we'd like to offer to get the bill into the form, which makes the most sense for governing.
All right. Chair Schumacher moves the A5 amendment with an author's amendment to get the bill in the shape that he would like the committee to consider it. Discussion to the amendment? Seeing the discussion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. And you may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members, for the adoption of the A5 amendment. It was largely technical. There was one piece in there, $1.2 million for the demolition of the Miller Building to prepare for the site for future construction of the Anoka Medical Regional Treatment Center. Outside of that, everything else in there was very technical in nature there. But I will just give a brief overview of Articles 1, 2, and 3, and then Chair Knorr will take the balance of the bill there so everyone has perspective of where we're at here. Article 1 is the Aging Services Bill. We work to change the descriptions and the mechanisms for how nursing homes are paid with their PDPM program versus the RUG model that is being currently used. It's a federal request that we make those changes, and so we first did that. We do pay for the Workforce Standards Board for the nursing homes, the Nursing Home Workforce Standards Board. There is money for that. I know there was an agreement that there would be the basic funding for that. We went ahead in our budget and front-loaded the costs in there. I think on this issue, there's no disagreement that the team members at the nursing home should be getting paid more. The disagreement is when does the state get involved with paying for it, and this bill takes the position that we should be paying for it when the costs are first realized. And so we do that in there, but the Workforce Standards Board is paid for in this bill. And then to offset some of what otherwise may have been reductions in nursing facility funding, we did a bed surcharge change in there. It's a hold harmless surcharge to the nursing facilities within that, but it will capture more federal dollars to help offset and get this budget balanced. Article 2 is disability services. And there we start differing from the governor in the disability waiver rate system cap to the inflation. The governor had it capped at 2%, and we are doing a 4% per year cap on the consumer price index urban piece of that. And so inflation was measured a few different ways in current law, and so we changed that to have a standard way, and then we capped that at a 4% increase per year on that, and that was another piece that was clarified in the amendment that was adopted today. Another piece that we address in here that we've been hearing a little bit about since the bill became public is the rate exception piece. Moving forward, our bill provides for a county cost share to that. Basically, what we were looking at there is when we look at the increases in the human service budget and where that trend was going and the pieces that weren't being able to be just contained or measured, this was one area that was affecting that piece. And really, it's because when this the exception piece was first thought about, we were expecting about 4% of county providers to be utilizing this, and turns out to be 25% of county providers utilizing this, which is a 600% increase above what was projected. Makes it really hard to budget when those are the pieces that we're dealing with there. And so within this, we do ask the counties to bring in and pay for part of that in their quest to pay for providers to be able to do the job that they need to do. We also step away from the absence and utilization factor, that 3.9% piece on there. I think, again, with the way that the budget trends have been growing, when we look at something that could potentially lead to an organization being able to bill for 379 days a year or being paid for 379 days a year, there's ways that we needed to step that back and do some more controlling, different from how the governor also presented with that. We do approve and pay for the SAUPCA contracts, and we delay the Waiver Reimagine program until January 1st of 2028. Article 3, the healthcare section, we reinstate some TEFRA fees, so families that have children with disabilities, their parents with income that is greater or equal to 675% of the federal poverty guidelines are going to be required to pay a premium in order to qualify for the medical assistance piece there. And Mr. Chair, with that, I'll turn it over to Chair Noor.
Chair Noor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will start with Article 4, which is the behavioral health. We create a certification process and state-based centralized list for recovery residents, previously known or called as sober homes. And we also include housing support funding. The state will be taking the lead in that process rather than the counties. We reformed the eligibility for behavioral health fund for substance use services. Instead of the 1 year, we are capping it to 60 days and making sure that those individuals are moved to medical assistance so we can get the federal match. We increase substance use disorder rates by adding inflations to the rates and funds low and high intensity substance use treatments. We fund the last mile aspect of PRTF, particularly in Clay County, so they can provide services for children with mental health crises across the state. We make some tweaking in the substance use disorder treatment aligned with the federal guidelines, and we also create some program integrity provisions, including 15-minute unit for additional, and we also do additional reviews. Under Article 5, the background studies, we add background study requirement for owners, operators, employees, volunteers who provide direct contact in home and community-based services, housing stabilization, and EIDBI. We also require the commissioner to disqualify providers owning or operating services provided if they are violating the program integrity provisions. We also have under Chapter Article 6, program integrity, we create program integrity surcharge for all DHS providers. Right now, if you are within the Department of Health licensing, you pay a fee, not in DHS. So we are using the surcharge to provide Steps for Success, which is now available for PCA and DWRS, for almost all the providers, including the unlicensed services as housing stabilization, peer recovery, and EIDBI. We implement early and often training program for those within home and community-based services when providers begin to bill MA and when there is a change in ownership within 12 months. We fund FTEs to be able to provide program integrity, and it allows the commissioner, the authority, to review those licenses within 12 months. It gives the commissioner licensing moratorium authority on services that are increasing so that they're able to provide a better guidance with consultation of the chairs. It gives authority for payment withhold to the commissioner and also temporary suspense licenses where they're suspected prior. Under Article 7, direct care and treatment, you've heard about the capacity increase for the Miller Building 1.2. We're hoping that there'll be increased funding so that we can address the need in direct care and treatment. Likewise, we're increasing We are pushing the MSOP and inpatient examination competency attainment program starting in the planning years so that it doesn't have an impact to the counties. We also include $5 million ongoing for special fund for DCG electronic health records that we created last session to make sure that they have a sustainable fund. Under Article 8 for homeless housing and support services, we secure the housing support rate by protecting it for any federal cuts for the SNAP program. We eliminate the housing support supplemental enhanced rate or special rates that exist, and we're expanding the housing support program by looking into ways to fund ongoing. We enhance integrity surrounding housing stabilization for MA. We also have grants for Homeless Youth Act, Emergency Services Program, Shelter Capital, Safe Harbor for Youth grants. We also fund point-in-time homeless count census for the next 3 years by funding Wilder Foundation, which has been doing all that. Members and Mr. Chair, I think this was a difficult budget, as you can see and hear. But I just wanted to start with telling the counties. I've had from several counties, this budget does not have a significant impact compared to what the governor was recommending. So for so many counties who have been coming to you and saying this will have a significant impact, I want them to come and talk to me and Chair Schumacher, because we want to explain what we did in this bill. We are actually funding the DNMC and the DCT, which was supposed to be paid by the counties. We're shifting some of those responsibilities to the state so they don't have to incur any additional cost. And yes, there is a small provision when it comes to rate exceptions. The counties have full authority to decide how they utilize rate exception when it comes to disability services, and we're only asking them to provide a 16.67. We're going to work with the counties to develop guidelines. There's a need for monitoring. There's also a need to make sure that the funds that we provide under the rate exception goes to the service providers. It doesn't have to line with the CEOs who are making a significant income. We want that to go directly to the provision of the services. If it's equipment, all those things need monitoring and to be able to provide those services. So we are very careful not to cut any program, but to continue the funding for those programs. As you have had from PCA to nursing homes to home care program, we are aligned in terms of ensuring, Chair Schumacher and I, not to create any cuts, but to provide services for those who are most vulnerable members in our community, who are seniors, who are people with disabilities, vulnerable individuals, and we have done our best to remain within the target that is, quite frankly, a significant cut, but we've adjusted some of the programs to meet that guideline. And I'll let Chair Schumacher explain some of those things that I think we have missed, including this small note that I'll give to him.
Chair Schumacher.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, I think, you know, in a lot of ways this bill, there's definitely some tweaking that we can do to it and improvements as we understand some of these programs more. There is the one area that Chair Noor had pointed out, that the priority admissions funding that's in there that the county should like. In this overall, that's kind of it's still a work group that we're trying to get all the parties together and work out final language for that. And we think that there's a little bit of a carrot and stick in trying to get that in a better position than where it's at today. And so I just try to use every opportunity I can to encourage the parties to stay at the table and to get an agreement done with that we can live with and that the counties are going to be happy with and can work with in the end. With that, yes, it was a challenge to be able to put this together. I would say the biggest disagreement that Chair Noor and I had throughout the entire time was who should carry the bill. leadership decided that I was going to lose that one, and so here we are with that. But I do want to take a moment, too, to thank our staff from the Republican side, Megan Rossbach, for her work in committee and making sure that she didn't sneeze on me at every hearing, and then House Research as well, Daniel Pinelli and Sarah Sunderman for their work in all of this and understanding these areas enough to be able to put language together based off of the little bit of understanding that Chair Noor and I have of this, and to be able to put our words into something that can fit in a bill like this has been tremendous.
Discussion to the bill. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the presentation by the co-chairs. And I know this is always a difficult committee to finalize a budget on, let alone with the balance of power that we have here. As a resident of Anoka County, my property taxes went up 18% just this last year. And I'm just wondering net-net what we're looking at for the counties. Some of the county costs are going up, some are going down. What can I expect? And what can the counties expect as far as, just the net-net on what's being done in this bill?
Chair Schumacher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Scott. I can't give you a good answer or a solid answer on that. We're still getting the runs put together for what the impact would be per county, particularly with the rate exception piece. We need to understand better who's requesting those rate exceptions, what they're requesting them for, that sort of thing, and then have it broken down by county so we have an understanding of that. And so at the moment, I can't give you a good number. We've requested that information both from the counties and from the Department of Human Services, so it'll be nice when we can compare notes on there and see where we're truly at with that.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And do we expect to have those runs prior to us voting this off the House floor?
Chair Schumacher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Scott, I can't speak to that at the moment.
All right,
I think,
thank you.
Representative Scott.
I'm good, thanks.
Okay. Chair Gomez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted, I can't hear talk of year over year property tax increases like that without mentioning the property tax refund targeting program. If you see a 12% increase in your property taxes year over year, regardless of your income, please look into that program because it's available to all Minnesotans. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
It was.
I'm sorry, what's the name of that program?
It was of great value to the people of Anoka County. Now, we, in fairness, we had, I think, 3 years, as Representative Scott knows, where it was zero in a row. And so bills came due at some point. But it was a good, it was a program that we in Anoka County particularly appreciate this year. Representative Novotny.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Don't know which one will answer this. Representative Schumacher, probably. You discussed the nursing home bed rate surcharge increase up to almost $6,000. And you said that that would help capture some federal dollars. Could you describe that process or what that means?
Chair Schumacher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Novotny, yes. So the federal government allows for a surcharge to the nursing homes for the beds that they're utilizing. And we were allowed to charge, or the state's allowed to charge up to $6,000, and it essentially becomes a pass-through for federal. It's a mechanism to bring down federal dollars for that. And so they match those funds that are collected in the surcharge. We see the same thing with hospitals and a few other groups in the state, but this was a mechanism there for that. And what we did in this bill was to ensure that the extra fees, the surcharges that the nursing homes are paying, that gets reimbursed immediately, and then the extra drawdown goes to the overall budget piece.
Representative Novotny.
All right, thank you, Chair. And one last question. You discussed that the nursing home wage contract made adjustments for that, so that's a statewide standardized rate that's going to be charged to nursing home employees. How much is that going to be costing us?
Chair Schumacher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Novotny. The full detail or the full impact would be House File 1419 to look at the fiscal note of that. What we paid for in this bill was the impact directly to nursing facilities, and I can't remember what it is per year, but over the 4 years it was $95 million.
Thank you, Chair. That'll be all.
Representative Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I have same kind of concerns with the county impact as well. I'll kind of be waiting for that. But I wanted to spend a moment on the behavioral health side of things. And I want to thank both co-chairs a lot for their work on the SUD reimbursements this year. Again, I've sat on Health and Human Services for my entire time here until this year. And I know that the rates of how we reimburse our treatment facilities, the programs around that, the little tweaking we've been doing over the years is is good, but right now this is really making a significant difference. The biggest crack that we have, I believe, in our work in Minnesota is how we maintain our workforce and our treatment facilities. This bill is really going to help that. And I want to say thank you for finding the funds to do that, to working through. You guys had a really tough challenge of this target. And again, we have seen from the rate studies how horribly underpaid our staff has been over the years. And if we don't have a good treatment system in the state of Minnesota, all the prevention, all the other things that we're working around, all the naloxone distribution, doesn't really matter if we don't have good systems set up. So I just want to make sure that you're recognized, and all the members that worked on this bill with you is recognizing some very good rate reforms when it comes to reimbursements for our treatment centers. Again, if you don't know this, Minnesota has done a very good job nationally with reducing the overdose deaths as compared to our states in the county, in the country. We're down 24%. It is nowhere near where we need to get to, but we're leading the country in making a difference in reducing overdose deaths. And there's so many groups out there, so many factions, so many organizations that should take some credit to that. Again, it starts a lot of it with us right here, and I want to thank the co-chairs for their good work on this. So thank you so much.
Representative Mahler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just wanted to thank the co-chairs for your work on this, and just also note that there's a lot of uncertainty in the federal government right now about potential cuts to Medicaid, and I know that this bill, we can't predict the future, and we don't know what those are going to be, and so just sort of want to raise the concern I have. I'm supportive of the bill, but just what those cuts mean for the people that we are helping and protecting in Minnesota with this bill. So that's all. Just wanted to make that note. Thank you.
Yeah, and Chair Nord, did you want to speak to that?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I think we are all aware of the impending cuts that are going to be happening, about $890 billion. So that is about $1.5 billion cut if we see that come to fruition. So I'm hoping that we can try to talk to our colleagues, the federal representation we have, to really help us so that this is going to have devastating impact on our budget. It's going to have devastating impact on the people that we serve, especially our kids. More than 42% of our kids are on Medicaid, and the seniors who are depending on nursing homes, people with disability, it's going to have a significant impact. So this is something that we need to be advocating for. Hopefully we can come together and send a resolution to Congress to avoid this cut.
Representative Rarick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm looking at Article 6, and I'm wondering if you could just describe a little bit for the committee some of the fraud prevention parameters that you put in and some additional things you're allowing the commissioner to do and the agencies to do to stop fraud, because obviously that's a huge problem, as we're finding in the news almost every day and on the fraud committee.
Chair Noor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think based on our formula, we created a surcharge program whereby, for example, in EIDBI, they don't pay a fee. It's going to be $2,100 that we're going to be collecting. We're putting that in a special revenue account so that when we get those funds, we're able to fund FTEs within the Office of Inspector General who will be able to provide some training for Steps for Success. So individuals who are billing for Medicaid will have to understand the rules and requirement for that. And then we're also implementing early and often, meaning that we will be reviewing the providers, so there'll be more direct contact with the licensing team, the support structure that we're creating. We'll also give some parameters for the commissioner to be able to stop any fraud immediately. So this is more of a integrated process whereby we are collecting the surcharge from the providers, and we're going to reinvest back in providing them services that they've been requiring. So there'll be more training and also more understanding of what needs to be done.
Representative Rarick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you also speak to the data practices that you're allowing data sharing between agencies, it looks like, so that you can more effectively prosecute suspected crime or find fraud more easily? So if someone has basically got a red flag or something, a flag on their name or their business or their nonprofit, then that can be tracked through the system, it looks like.
Chair Noor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So for any risk programs, we're trying to make sure that there is coordination and that information can be shared immediately with the agency. So the commission will have the authority to take immediate action rather than wait for the outcome of that investigation.
Representative Eric.
Thank you.
Representative Cagle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Nora or Schumacher, I'm not sure who which. In Article 4, the residency requirements, I'm looking here and it says that all residents are allowed to use legally prescribed drugs and treatment for opioid use disorders. Does this mean that all of the recovery residents are required to allow MATs?
Chair Nora.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That was part of the creation of the process whereby we're following the national standards, whereby we're trying to make sure that individuals who are in recovery residence, they're able to utilize medication to help them.
Representative Cagle.
Thank you.
Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Nord. Chair Schumacher, I just wanted to say thank you for the work you've done here. I'm going to highlight particularly the mental health areas of the bill, the school-linked mental health, continuing that, and the increase specifically in intensive residential treatment centers and psychiatric residential treatment facilities. This I find really a balanced approach in so many areas, but especially mental health. And building that continuum of care out is very visible in this bill, so I thank you for your work in that area. I think that if we as a body can move ahead and also add to your work with a rate reform bill, which is close, this would be the most significant mental health productive session in decades in Minnesota, and it would be really an impressive feat for this legislature to do it in a bipartisan way and address a serious problem that is only going to continue to be something we need to be following and treating as we go forward. So thank you for your work.
Representative Gomez.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair. And I just want to add my thanks to Chairs Neuer and Schumacher. Human services, I think, is probably the most complex policy area that we have in state government. You both have just, over years, really built your expertise, and we just are so, so lucky to have both of you with your background knowledge. And I think you can see, like, when you look at the really difficult target that you had, and you know the fact that you can say that to us, for the message for us to bring to our counties, because I know I'm not the only one who throughout this session has heard real deep concern from our counties about some of the governor's proposals and the ways that that would impact then the way that they would have to turn to their property tax levies, which is basically the only way that they have to pay for some of these services that we collectively as government have to provide to our people. And I just wanted to mention two things that are really important to me. First is that, you know, again, you had a much more difficult target than the Senate did. And I want to thank you so much for the investment in homelessness that is in this bill. It's significant. It continues the work that we were able to do together in 2023 and acknowledges how central that is to ensuring that our people have healthy and lives that are possible for them and their families. And I want to thank Chair Baker for his comments about the work on substance use disorder treatment and about, you know, the strides that we've made in overdose prevention, but that overdose prevention doesn't matter if you don't have the services there when people are ready to make that change in their lives. And so I thank you for maintaining those investments. And I just have to mention that, you know, it's true that overall we have, you know, I think that the investments that we made in overdose prevention in 2023, they were very significant. They were historic. We, our community partners and our Department of Health has done amazing things with them. And so we do see that top line number of overdose deaths having gone down 24%, which is really significant. The fact remains, though, that Native Minnesotans are 15 times more likely to overdose than white Minnesotans. Black Minnesotans are 3 times more likely to overdose than white Minnesotans. We have more work to do. And so I just, when it's important that we look at that disaggregated data when we see some of those really hopeful top line results that we should celebrate, but we got to kind of lift the hood a little bit. So just wanted to express my gratitude to you for your continued care for some Minnesotans that some people don't feel they have to care about, you know, folks experiencing homelessness and people who are struggling with substance use disorder. Thank you.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate getting to go a second time here. I do have another question. It's for Representative Knorr. Representative Knorr, in this omnibus bill, you have your bill, House File 2722, and it has to do with positive support professional, some training. It talks about competency-based training program. And about 4 years ago, we set up the Competency Attainment Board. And as you know, there's a significant amount of money being spent on that. They're still trying to get all their hiring done. What's the difference between what your bill does and what the Competency Attainment Board is doing and the work of those, I think they're called navigators?
Chair Knorr. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Scott, we're not changing the positive support program. What we're creating is putting a training program whereby the requirement under the, I believe there was a master level requirement. I don't have it in front of me. We're just making it some adjustment for those who will be trained with their qualification based on scope of practice that they can provide positive support.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm still not clear. Is your bill working in concert within the Competency Attainment Board? Is it something separate?
Chair Knorr. Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is the qualification for individuals who are providing positive support, not the maybe I can phone a friend, Mr. Chair. I do have
you
the
can.
Agency here. They can explain better in terms of what changes we're making in that area.
That would be really helpful, I think.
I see
all each other, I think.
House Fiscal
oh,
coming up. Is someone from the... Looks
here
like someone's coming up
to
the front, and if you could just state your name for the record and position, and then you can answer the question to the best of your ability.
As Chris is finding a way. So I think the confusion is we're using competency there, but it's nothing to do with what Chair Scott is stating. So I think I'll let...
Great. If you could just state your name for the record, then you can try and answer the question or clear things up for us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Christy Grum. I'm with the Department of Human Services. Representative Scott, so the Competency Attainment Board, which is not my expertise, is my understanding that is a board that's dealing with individuals who are not deemed competent to stand trial, so a criminal trial. And so that's a separate issue to make sure that that board is addressing that issue to make sure people have access to those services and related services to make sure they can be competent to stand trial. The competency for positive support professionals in Chair Knorr and Chair Schumacher's bill is related to a home and community-based services waiver service called Positive Supports, which is a service that is targeted generally to people who have really high behavioral needs and was developed as part of some of the Johnson settlement requirements to reduce the use of restraints and seclusions for people with disabilities. So what this provision is doing is just changing the training requirements to make them less rigorous for those providers or less, I don't want to, maybe rigorous isn't the right word, but so that they don't have to jump through hoops where they might, someone might be on a different level. So I might know, I might be able to complete a training requirement and meet competency for that, to deliver that particular service based on my experience and education quicker than someone else does. So this just makes sure that providers are able to have not a one-size-fits-all training requirement, that they can meet competency wherever they're at.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That helps. Thank you.
All right. Chair Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd just like to add my voice to the chorus of praises for your hard work, given a very difficult target. But also like to thank you for the work you've done to try and protect our nursing homes in this bill that allows some of our most vulnerable citizens to be cared for as close to home as possible, which is by far the best outcome for them. And I thank you for what you've done to protect nursing homes in this bill, and look forward to seeing that maintained as we come out of conference.
And
thank
I,
you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, I will join Chair Torkelson and many other members in just a round of thanks to the two chairs of this committee. You had the second biggest budget area and the largest cut target, and yet you're coming forward with a bill which you completed on time, by the way, which I think is also really worth saying. But you're coming for a bill that's garnering praise all the way from Chair Torkelson to Chair Gomez, which is kind of crazy if you think about it.
Spectrum.
Yeah, it is a spectrum. And I, in, for myself, I am with Representative Bierman in being pleased with the work on mental health, and I think it intersects really well with Representative Baker's points and Representative Gomez's points. You know, homelessness and substance use and mental health are inextricably intertwined, those three issues. And so I'm really, really grateful for the phenomenal work you've done, and I appreciate it very much. So we'll move to closing comments first from Chair Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and co-chairs for the good target. Hopefully we can improve it going forward. And so just wanted to thank my co-chair, Chair Schumacher, for being more flexible. We never traded any office, by the way. Unlike any other group, we were able to sit down and figure out the best way going forward, given the challenging target that we got. And without saying more, I just wanted to thank our researcher, Molly Peterson, for her great work and giving us what we needed. Also, the GOP researcher, Tom Brennan. We could not have done this work without our CLS, Joseph Fruhoff and Elijah Henderson. Likewise, I wanted to thank the commissioner and her team, Christy Graham, who was here with us, Liz Bailey, who they don't sleep. They work 24 hours to get us what we want. But I also wanted to thank DCT, the CEO, and Marshall Smith and his team, Carrie Briones, and the team that came to us from DCT. I just wanted to make sure that we recognize their work because they're the ones who keep us moving forward. They're the ones who have been guiding us. And so I just wanted to say thank you to my co-chair. Hopefully in the next few days we'll be able to get a better target so we can have a balanced budget going forward. So thank you.
All right. And the final word to the author of the bill, Chair Schumacher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. I would echo what Chair Knorr said about everything in this process. It could have been a whole lot worse. The target was the worst part about this, but the people that we got to work with, the ideas that came forward, the decisions that were made and how we got there, it could have been much worse, but we were able to get this to a point that it's a tight bill, it's ready for prime time, and we're happy with that. And if joint committee were to decide that we should have a slightly better target in order to do a little bit more good with the good work we've already done, we would not object.
And with that, Chair Schumacher renews his motion that House File 2434 as amended be recommended for placement on the general register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. And House File 2434 as amended is recommended to be placed on the general register. As people are exiting the room, if you can keep your voices down so we can continue to work, we will move on to the only bill that's larger than the Human Services Bill, the Education Finance Bill, House File 2433. And as Chairs Joachim and Kreisha make their way to the front, I will turn to Ms. Adrians and ask if she could state the target for this committee and whether the bill is in compliance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. The target for the Education Finance Committee is $40 million above the base for fiscal years 26 and 27, and the target in the TALES, fiscal years 28 and 29, is no change from the base that was established in the February forecast, and the bill is in compliance with these targets.
All right. So what we will do, members, is first we will entertain a motion to move the bill, and then there's a DE amendment that will move. We'll handle one amendment, and then we will have discussion before voting first on the DE and finally on the bill. So, Chair Joachim, would you like to move the bill?
Yes, I'll move House File 2433 before the committee.
Chair Joachim moves House File 2433 be recommended to be placed on the general register. Then, Chair Joachim, would you like to move, or Chair Kreisha, would you like to move the DE amendment?
I would like to move the DE amendment.
All right, Chair Kreisha moves the DE3 amendment. And I think now would be a good time to describe the bill, and then we'll go on to the one amendment. So Chair Youakim, if you would describe your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll describe the budget provisions, and Chair Co-Chair Crisha will describe the policy ones. So as Ms. Adrian said, we had a target of $40 million in the first biennium for the READ Act and zero in the TAILS. While we made great progress in the 23-24 session in both finance and policy, there was still more to do for the growing needs of our school districts, teachers, and students. I would like to thank the leadership team for a positive target for the READ Act, but a zero target in the TAILS did not allow us to provide an increase in investment in our schools. What we were able to do with this bill is to provide some flexibility in funding streams that the districts have been asking for while protecting the integrity of what the funding streams were intended to be used for. While this may not be the bill that I would have written myself and what Chair Crisha would have written alone, it reflects a compromise that a dynamic of a tight house required us to do to fund our schools. I'm happy that we're able to protect some of our major provisions we put in place last year, and we kept the policy changes to the minimum. We were able to protect linking the general education formula to inflation and universal meals. Some of the funding stream adjustments that we made, we were able to find some, by moving some things around, funding unemployment insurance for our hourly workers for the coming summer. That was Representative Ream's bill. And we provided ongoing flexible funding and a basic supplemental aid that school districts can use to cover these costs going forward. That was Representative Bakeberg's bill. But my biggest disappointment is having to make an agreement to remove unemployment insurance after the summer of 2028. The hourly workers in our schools play a pivotal role in our students' education and deserve the same benefits as hourly workers across the state. It's my hope that we can find a way to retain unemployment aid for our school hourly workers as we move forward. We were able to maintain the intended use for the funds for student support personnel aid. I think there was a letter, but I think it was stapled in the health one packets. It's about middle of the road from the licensed school social workers, counselors, nurses, and psychologists, those organizations, which SPA has helped to get those licensed professionals in our school. We did have to slow down the growth in the per pupil aid, and I'll cover that a little bit in our reductions and reallocation talk. All of us have concerns about our state dollars being used and wanted to rethink legislatively appointed grants. Most of the grants that we have in K-12 arena are one-time funds, but there are a few that have base funding and that were legislatively appointed versus competitive grant process. So those grants were our Center for the Book, Starbase, Blackman Teach, that administration of TOCAT, not the grants to the teachers, but just the administration piece, and the Sane Foundation. We were able to keep the grant funding in the first biennium and then remove the funds from the base in the second. The exception is the Sane Foundation that keeps funding steady in 26, cuts it in half in 27, and then removes the base in the second biennium like the other grants. It's my hope that together next year we can figure out a process in which a nonprofit and a school district can apply to MDE through a competitive grant process. While we do not have the funds to provide MDE, PELSBY, BOSA, the state academies, or PERPICH with their operating adjustments, we are able to keep their base funding as is and able to find MDE's litigation costs, fund MDE's litigation costs at $40 million instead of the $6 million that was requested. There is $40 million in the first biennium for the READ Act that will be distributed to schools on a per-pupil basis that will be equal to either a $2,000 base or $45.70 times each number of students served, whichever is larger. I would like to thank Representative Clardy for the finance piece and Representative Mueller for her work on the policy pieces of the READ Act. We fund a task force to examine the compensatory aid revenue with Representative Feist's bill. We fund the Minnesota Youth Council for the first biennium with Representative Sensor-Murrah, and this is an organization that from students across the state that we've actually have in statute as a statutory requirement to have students give us feedback on the bills we're doing that affect them. Currently, 30 larger school districts are allowed to use their long-term facility maintenance funds to fix their roofs. Think of that as like if you tip a building upside down, a school building, everything that falls out is not LTFM. Everything that stays there is long-term facilities maintenance. The other 300 schools could not use that to fix their roofs, and we changed that in a second biennium with a bill from Representative Vernick. We have Representative Dotseth's bill to fund consolidation transition aid for our rural districts that might be consolidating in both bienniums.
some money for Math Corps with Representative Rauer, Representative Berg's Map Stars. This is a very small appropriation for the alternative schools for them to be able to do extracurricular activities and build leadership skills. We fund an intermediate special education apprenticeship for $6 million for Representative Clardy's bill. This program is going to be graduating 23 new special education teachers. And they're trained for level 4, which is a Fed setting that's a little tougher to get teachers for. We captured $2 million of MDE's funds that were going to be canceled back. And then, like I said before, one of the important things that Representative Co-Chair Krisha wanted to bring forward with Representative Bakeberg's bill was this idea of basic supplemental aid. This is a per-pupil funding stream that districts will receive that is flexible, almost as flexible as general education funding is. In order to create this funding stream, we slowed down the growth in the student support aid. We reallocated library aid funds, and then we slightly reduced the 100% reimbursement you get for transportation for kiddos with special needs to 95%, but made sure the 100% stayed for the highly mobile and homeless students and students going to treatment. I could go into details, but I think I'll leave it at that and turn it over to Chair Krisha. I could go into more details about the reductions and exact numbers, but your eyes will glaze over, so I'm going to just pitch it to Chair Krisha to go through the policy changes.
Chair Krisha.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Chair Joachim. I'd like to bring up nonpartisan Ms. Pera, who can walk through objectively the policy, and then I'll give the color commentary.
Ms. Pera, whenever you are ready, you may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Christina Pera from House Research. The two primary policy changes in the bill relate to unemployment insurance and the READ Act. With unemployment insurance, it's modifying the provision that was adopted in 2023 relating to the, it's between breaks for the non-instructional employees in K-12 so that they would not be able to receive unemployment benefits if they had a reasonable assurance of employment in the fall. And that would take effect after the summer of 2028. And then with the READ Act, there are a number of changes to definitions, primarily relating to the science of reading, so modifying definitions such as evidence-based, a new definition of science-based research, and generally requiring instruction, literacy instruction to be based on the science of reading. There are provisions in the READ Act also from the governor, as well as Representative Mueller, Clardy, and Perez Vega relating, for example, to the dual immersion programs and exempting those from compliance with the READ Act unless they're providing instruction in English, literacy instruction in English, and then requiring teacher candidates to demonstrate they can provide literacy instruction that's based on the science of reading. Also terminating the partnership between the Department of Education and the CARI, which is an institute at the University of Minnesota, so terminating that partnership early so that the funds canceled back in July 1 and the Department of Education would complete those implementation activities on its own. Mr. Chair, those are the main policy provisions. There are a couple of others relating, for example, to Math Corps and providing evidence-based instruction, but it was mostly the unemployment insurance and the READ Act.
Chair Krisha, anything else?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Ms. Pera, for that. So, members, I'll take you back to how this all came together in a short history. We come back coming out of COVID, very difficult times, and we saw the ESSRA funds drying up. We saw that schools are dealing with the uncertainty, declining enrollment, increasing special ed costs. All of that is culminating to a November budget that showed the signs of a declining budget overall for statewide. Coming into that and the very difficult job that our chairs had, our co-chairs in Ways and Means, to give us a target, and we received a zero target. We received on the base and then $40 million for the READ Act and then a 2028 repeal date from leadership. Those were the 3 points that we had going into our discussion. That comes from the conversation the schools offering out, as well as the employees and the advocates, of two positions that were stated out on UI. either repeal it right away, or on the far other side of that was leave it in place but don't fund it. So somewhere in between that spectrum is what we were dealing with. I believe where we landed here is we have $30 million in the first year, which allows us to put some special ed savings in place, and then moving to the basic supplemental aid and allowing schools to start to have the conversations with their employees on how they can mitigate this. The reality is, as I look at this, the best unemployment insurance is the ones you don't use. It's the ones where you help the employees find their jobs, and not all schools have that. I understand there's extenuating circumstances, but by moving the dollars to the basic supplemental aid, we allow the schools and hopefully start to build that partnership and building these jobs out. That, I think, is the ideal solution in finding a way to reduce that. We prioritize funding that's fair and flexible for schools. The redirect of $150 million over the next 4 years into the basic supplemental aid will definitely help the schools, the school boards, and all the employees and the management and labor groups as they talk through this, navigate the uncertainty that's in front of them. There is uncertainty. There's no question about that. And that will need to offer some flexibility to offset that. It continues the commitment of the science of reading and the academic achievement. We don't put any more dollars into the state agencies, increasing the Department of Education, PELSB, their standards board, or the PERPISH. We have to all look at our budgets, and we have to all look for efficiencies across the board. We eliminate the funding for the legislatively named nonprofits and requiring MDE to terminate nonprofit payments or programs failing to maintain timely reports and registration. We are in an era of increased accountability and asking for that type of transparency, and that's extended down. Rejecting the governor's plan that would have slashed educational funding and students by $680 million and denying, frankly, a difficult budget. And by getting to the zero place and fighting for that, I think that was a big win for everyone involved. So with that, I would offer this bill to the Ways and Means. I think that where we have landed is a good agreement. It's a good place to take this forward. And frankly, it's probably the only place we could have gotten to. And I say that with all the respect in the world for my colleagues as we worked across this incredibly humble people listening to everything and trying to really solve the problems that were in front of us. And so with that, I thank my team and everyone that worked on this bill.
Okay, before we move to discussion of the bill, there is one additional amendment, and I believe Representative Pinto will be offering the A22 amendment. Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and while I'm thinking of it, I'll respectfully request a roll call on the amendment.
There will be a roll call.
Thank you, sir. Well, first, I do want to thank both the chairs for their incredibly hard work on this bill, for everything that you put into it. The A22 would reverse the rollback of the hourly school workers' unemployment insurance that is currently law. I want to note for members maybe less familiar that this is the only group of seasonal workers not to have this right. It requires them to actively seek employment to 50% wage replacement if they worked in landscaping, if they worked in some entertainment venue, whatever it is, have access to this, but not the folks who work in our K-12 schools. I looked into the history of this, and actually the reason for the exemption originally decades and decades ago was that the expectation was that these were generally moms whose kids were in school and they needed a little bit extra cash, so they were working during the school year, and then when the summer hits, they're home with their kids. And it is, in fact, the case that it is disproportionately women and people of color who are doing these jobs, and they are faced so often with a really, really challenging decision to make. Do they somehow float their expenses over the summer? There was powerful testimony in the committee chaired by our two chairs about folks having to shut off their utilities, having to put off necessary healthcare procedures, even going without food for the summer months. Of course, the other option is that they start another job, and very often they end up sticking with that other job, adding to our shortages of staff in schools. A reminder that under this law currently, They are, in fact, required to actively seek employment in the summer. It may well be with that school district, it may be elsewhere. They are only entitled to this 50% wage replacement if they are actively seeking employment. But to have them, folks who are disproportionately, who are the lowest paid staff in our schools doing this and be put in this situation is extremely challenging. I'll also note, and my understanding is that this is, in fact, fully paid for through these, for our school districts as well, through kind of the mechanisms in the bill and in the law. There is no reason that we should have the school bus driver who is the familiar, friendly face not having access to this when the summer hits and getting 50% wage replacement as they're actively seeking employment. The cafeteria worker who knows the allergies of the kids going through the line, and many of us, I think, can think about some of those friendly faces. The paraprofessionals helping our kids to learn, to have them not have access to the same benefit that other seasonal workers receive makes no sense and is really unconscionable. And so, chairs, I certainly hope that we can support this and really recognize the work of these people taking care of our kids, and maybe in recognition of those folks who took care of us when we were in our schools, school years as well. So I would urge a yes vote. Thank you, Chair.
Discussion to the amendment. Representative Katisa-Watoon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Chair Pinto, for bringing this amendment forward. Chair Joachim and, Chair Kreisha, this is a really tough pill to swallow. And I think, you know, removing this provision takes us backward for the people who are committed to serving our kids on a daily basis throughout the school year. As a legislator, you know, we have to look from all these different angles. And so I know that you're in a tough situation, but I think that, you know, as a parent to students who ride the bus and who have gone through special education programming and made relationships that have changed the trajectory of my kids' life because of the consistency and the care that they are provided by our paraprofessionals, I can't support the DE amendment without removing this provision. I appreciate that it does give us a little bit of a time for a sunset so that schools can, you know, continue planning and making moves for the future. It gives a little bit of a cushion for these workers so that the support isn't just ripped out from underneath them. But, you know, I think so many of our districts in greater Minnesota and here in the metro core as well, we're dealing with a tremendous bus driver shortage just a couple years ago. And this is one of the reasons, you know, when they don't have access to unemployment insurance over the summertime, they are looking for replacement wages. They're looking for other jobs that they that can provide additional consistency. And I'll tell you what, my four-year-old, his face just lights up whenever he gets on the bus. And I guess I'll give a direct shout out to Matt and Liz, incredible bus drivers in the Eden Prairie schools. Eden Prairie is in a unique position because we actually maintain a totally internal transportation department, and so we employ our bus drivers directly. Many other districts don't have the capacity to do that, and then they are hiring out, and I think that it is this giant cycle that continues, like the bus wheels keep turning, right? And it does ongoing damage to the students who don't have, who can't count on those friendly faces welcoming them. And for the special ed students who, truthfully, you know, may go through teacher after teacher, year after year, and not find that one person who lights them up inside and helps them see just how to best approach the school day. And if they then case management shifts, that paraprofessional doesn't come back that following year, it really, really can be difficult. Difficult for that child, difficult for the classroom teacher, because now they're dealing with a kid who was used to the support and had a trusting relationship built with their paraprofessional. Can't say that word today. It's difficult for the parents, knowing that our kids are going to school
and struggling because that person, their person, is maybe not going to be able to return the next school year. And so I think that it's so important that, you know, Chair Pinto pointed out that this segment of our workforce and our school population, they're the only workers in the state that don't qualify, haven't qualified until we made this change. And now to take that back is going to be really terrible. And the ways don't always justify the means, I guess. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Noor.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have got some clarifying questions that I wanted to ask under page 10, subdivision 7A, section 12. That touches the higher education employees. So just wanted to get clarifying. Are we taking away the unemployment for higher education staff with this change?
And no, do we want the authors to take that or not?
Yeah, I'll try. I might have to pitch it to Ms. Barra. No, actually, that makes sure we maintain the higher ed one because that would have been that was already negotiated in the higher ed committee. Maybe Ms. Barra,
Ms. Barra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Noor. The law for the employees of the higher education institutions would not change. So. In section 11, what you see is there's an expiration date for that subdivision that currently covers both K-12 and higher ed, and then two new provisions are codified, one for higher ed, just copying current law. So that's what would apply there in section 12, and section 13 is for the K-12 employees, and that's law as it was before 2023.
Representative Noor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I also wanted to follow up with subdivision 8A when we're talking about services by school contractors.
And
Chair Crescia.
Was there a question there?
Representative Noor.
Yes, it looks like we are codifying again the service employees, the food services, so they will be able to receive unemployment. Is that correct?
Chair Crescia.
Mr. Chair, so as if I understand it, and Ms. Perry can help me, if you are a contracted service and that unemployment is offered through that, one of the challenges that we have with the unemployment situation is, as the law stands now, this would incentivize school districts to do, say, for example, cleaning companies, lawn service companies, food service companies, contracting with folks so they're not wrapped up in this legislation. So I believe that section, we do not touch the contractors because that's not in our purview. Did I get that right, Ms. Perry?
Ms. Perry.
Mr. Chair, members, so Section 14, part of the 2023 change was repealing what was then, I believe it was Subdivision 8, relating to the contractors. So Section 14 is bringing that exact language back, what was there before 2023. And I believe there it's Paragraph A says whether the wage credits are applicable, and Paragraph B is which ones are not. So it depends on which part of it you're looking at.
Representative Noor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is exactly why we have a problem, because we're only picking one group versus everyone else. So when you see the language in Subdivision 8A, we have only picked those who are providing food services. We're excluding the school bus drivers. We're excluding anyone who's providing contracts. So yes, we went back to where we were in before we extended to all the hourly workers. And now we're trying to pick and choose who's a winner and who's a loser in this process. That's why initially we instituted this change, to make sure that we equalize the system. You don't have to be treated different because of who you are and who you work for. And quite frankly, there are many entities who have got a contract. Let's say you have a school bus driver. They're paying into the trust fund right now. With this language, that we are prohibiting the hourly school or non-instructional workers, will actually prohibit us providing an employment to those school bus drivers, because we have instituted pick and choose, just like any seasonal workers right now. If you're in construction, you get an employment. If you're in another industry, you get an employment. But because you're an hourly school worker, we're telling you, no, you're not going to get it. And we're picking who's going to win and who's going to lose. So this is exactly why we have got a problem with this change that we're instituting today. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Mamani. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I drove the school bus for 2 years, and I remember getting back from my first route with Mr. Speck on the bus, and he was the owner of the company, and he had driven my bus when I was a kid. And when we got back, he said the one line that I'll never forget. Says, you know, Paul, never forget that when you're driving the school bus, you have the world's most precious cargo on board. So that stuck with me, and it made me focus on the fact that my job as a school bus driver was to get the kids safely to and from school and to make sure that nothing happened outside or inside the bus. So I guess I just learned that I was also responsible for the health and welfare of the kids from what we just learned in committee here. I'm sorry for the kids that were on my bus that I didn't help you with your homework. I was focused on keeping you safe and sound. Representative Kreshaw, I know it's in the packet here, but just for the public out there, could you tell them what this is going to save over the biennium?
Mr. Chair, so Representative Novotny, are you looking at just dollars or?
The dollars.
So thank you. So what the agreement has in front of you here is the first year, $30 million will go into the UI, and that UI is basically a reimbursable account that districts, as folks apply for that, that will be reimbursed back. And then there's a special ed savings because they can charge back to that. In the second year of the, and first year of buy-in, we also move some of the money in the BSA so that there's a total of over 70 total. That money will be fully flexible for schools that they can use in the second year if they continue to have UI claims. But it also allows them to negotiate so that they can try to extend those jobs to the bus drivers, because there are other summer jobs. There is other summer work. As Chair Pinto identified, these employees, if they ask for the UI claims, have to go out and look for other jobs. So why not try to find those jobs within the school and give the schools the dollars in the basic supplemental aid account? And what we're really saving is jobs and people. I also remember in the towns that I've been at and watching Hennepin Paper Mill closed, the boat factories closed, and when people would get UI benefits, what they would do, and I was working retail at the time, is they would come in and say, hey, will you just give me an application and sign this so I can say I was out looking for a job? That's very demeaning to the people in the districts and the cities that I work at. Why not allow the schools to work with these and try to find, because there is summer work, there is plenty of things going on with kids and activities that we have. I'm just trying to, on my side, And I think in general, people I'm talking to, extend the jobs, not just the job benefits, but the jobs themselves into the summer months. So that's, I don't know if that gets to the exact answer of what you're looking for, but I'm actually not trying to save dollars. I'm trying to save jobs, and I'm trying to save workers.
Representative Devine. Thank you, Chair. Yes, you summed it up pretty well. So there's nothing stopping you from getting a different job. If you're going to college, you could take other jobs, golf course, pick up other things. I knew when I applied for this job that I would not be working in the summer driving bus. I knew that when I applied for the job, and I did other things. So, thank you. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, as one of the people around this table, there's a few of us that represent Anoka-Hennepin, the state's largest school district. I just wanted people to know what it was costing Anoka-Hennepin. $2.4 million just last summer. And that's an average of about $57 per pupil. The statewide average is $62 per pupil. And in Minneapolis is around $105 per pupil. And what I heard over and over again when we went to the school district's like pre-session meeting was, please give us mandate relief. So this is doing that. And what they were also running into was, as you were talking, Representative Kreshaw, Chair Kreshaw, is that many of those employees, they relied on those employees that were, you know, just during the school year to help with the summer programs and be paid for that. And when the UI benefits started, they saw a dramatic decrease in those jobs being filled. And some of those programs where those employees helped during the summer and took those summer jobs were to help get our kids caught up on the learning loss from the pandemic. And we're still way, way, way behind on that. So I think it's a good decision to do this. I think the school districts will be thankful for the flexibility that you're giving them. And I think there's more work to do on mandate relief. I understand the makeup of the committees and that we're evenly divided here. But again, it was the number one, two things that I heard over and over again from our school district was mandate relief and please fix the school disciplinary problem, because it was tying the hands of teachers, parents, and administrators. So I hope that something happens there too, but I think this is a step in the right direction, and I thank you for coming to this resolution.
I'm just gonna take the chair's prerogative to ask a question. Chair Joachim, you know, I believe that the extension of unemployment to hourly workers happened in 2023 when you were chair of the Education Finance Committee. When it was extended, was there funding for the school districts as part of that extension?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and yes, we funded $135 million in the first biennium, and we put $50 million in the base each year ongoing. The $135 million actually covered it more than the 2 years that we thought. It was 2.5. That's why we're backfilling the rest of this summer coming up. The reason why we did not allow districts to tap into their UI levy, and yes, members, districts do have a UI levy they can tap into, for all the other employees that receive unemployment insurance in the schools. And why we didn't do that is in the education realm. While I used to be the property tax chair, I am not any longer, and I cannot raise property taxes. And the UI levy is a base of property taxes that a school district can do by themselves without going directly to the voters for it. And we were getting mixed messages on cost and fiscal notes. The districts were saying 100% of our employees will take this. Deed's cost estimate was 50% of the employees. The first year, it was either around 27 or 37% folks did the uptake. It went up to about 40, 45. That's why the money lasted longer than expected. We wanted one more year this coming summer to see what that true number was before we took money to offset a levy that might be too much, and then that would be less money for the schools. So it was a conscious effort to figure out how much this was really going to cost before we offset the levy. And to your first answer is it has not cost any school district a dime yet, and it won't next summer.
Right. So when we said earlier there was a cost to Nokanathan schools of $2.4 million, that cost was picked up by the state. There was no cost borne by the school district itself.
And Mr. Chair?
Chair Kreisha.
I want to make sure that we do this correctly, and Chair Joachim is correct. Her previous budget funded this, so school districts were not on the hook. But what we saw coming in is times now when we have a zero base, and you look at what's in front of us, those dollars have, we have $33 million now. We're putting $30 in to cover the first one because there is a shortfall. And what districts are looking at, and they've been very clear, either give us all the money to cover the mandate or repeal it. We are looking at a situation where our budgets are suggesting that these dollars are going to start to evaporate, and they already are. So this becomes a concern for the schools saying, okay, if the mandate's still in place, and if you look at the last paragraph of the MinnPost article where the member says it was never in intention to fund this, schools were just going to have to do that, that's very scary to schools. I don't believe all the colleagues I served with, that was their intention. They wanted to fund this to take care of the employees. I believe that. What we're looking at is the reality of dollars and being in the Ways and Means Finances. We are seeing cut targets. We are seeing bases of zero. And we are seeing the reality of what the economy is facing us. And so that's why you have what you have here. I would also say, and I understand the position on the levy. Some districts have said, well, give us the levy authority. But the districts that I travel in, where I go to, they're also saying, listen, we're having a hard enough time passing levies now. And if the talk of the town is that UI is part of that levy, even though it comes from different places, this becomes divisive and very, very difficult. And I know that we have differences. I know that the areas that we have are different in how people look at things. But the communities that I'm at are very, very close, very tight-knit, and they understand this and they talk about this. And so trying to navigate this and by giving them the flexibility does become something that we can build partnerships. In the district I'm at now, they're at complete odds because we're looking at closing a school 10 miles away. And they're blaming everybody. And the reality is declining enrollment and special ed and other costs are getting them to a point where people will not pass levies to help the school. And the kids shouldn't have to suffer for that. So I just want to make sure I cleared the record that Chair Youakim and her budgets and so forth, this was covered by state aid.
Okay, members, I just want to note we are at 1:45 now. It is my intention that this bill will leave this committee before 2 o'clock. We are going to take the last two speakers on the list for this amendment. We're going to vote on the amendment. We'll have some time for discussion of the bill, but we will be voting the bill out of the committee before 2 o'clock. Representative Cleaborn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll keep my comments short. First, I'd like to acknowledge the hard work that both the chairs are trying to address, and I appreciate the fact that we may have different perspectives on how to fix the problem, but I do hear the passion and care and attention that you are both putting into your discussion. So I just want to acknowledge that. But I can't let it go that the positions that we ask individuals to fill, right, whether it's bus driver or para or whatever position it might be during the school year, these jobs are hard. And we are asking these individuals to do more and more and more, and the school districts are asking them to do it with less and less and less. A school bus driver, I cannot tell you how complicated that job is when you do it and you do it well. You are paying attention to the child's safety on the bus, not just from hazards in traffic, but hazards from other students, right? You are making sure that the person who is getting them to the bus actually showed up, and the person who was supposed to pick them up is the person who's really picking them up. And you are dealing with life and death issues for every hour that you get on that bus until you park that bus at the garage at night and you make sure it's empty. That job is a freaking hard job. And those people who do it and do it with dedication, I tip my hat to them. Now, the paras are the same, right? Their job is wholly focused on helping the student be the best student they can be. It's hard, it's grueling, and it can be very thankless. So when we think about who is deserving of UI and who is not deserving of UI, because we as a society have said school is 9 months, it's not that the bus drivers aren't willing to work 9 months. It's not that the paras aren't willing to work 9 months. We as a state have said the school year is 9 months. So now if we want those dedicated people to step up and do this hard work, we owe them the dignity of saying, when we can't provide you work, we will help you with that gap. Because I'll tell you what, any school district that is facing shortages will hang on to every bus driver and every para they have. And so this is really a value statement about how we value the work that we, the state, it's our obligation to provide public education, are putting into our budget. And these individuals who do this hard work deserve UI just like everybody else. And that's all I'll say about it. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for your indulgence.
Chairs Youakim and Krisha Uch have spoken to this issue a couple times, so I just want to give you the chance if you have anything very brief that you want to say before we close on the amendment. And I'm seeing no from...
Please vote yes.
Okay. And Representative Pinto, it's your amendment. If you have brief closing comments.
Yeah, it's been a decades-long struggle to ensure that those who, in fact, carry our most precious cargo, I appreciate you saying that, Representative Noddy, that they get the same opportunity as those who are doing landscaping on our lawns or working in amusement parks. When we cannot give these folks work and they can't find that work for themselves, We are simply saying that they should have one half of their already inadequate salary, the same as anybody else that does that work. We owe that to them. And a reminder that this is, in fact, fully paid for. Not a single school district has paid for this up until now. And, in fact, it's paid for using special ed funding and also supplemental aid as well. And that's true for any other seasonal worker. Let's treat these people the same with as other workers. Thank you, Chair.
With no further discussion, Ms. Prevett will take the roll and the chair votes aye.
Representative Stevenson votes aye. Chair Stevenson. Chair Torkelson.
Votes no.
Chair Torkelson, no. Representative Agbaje.
Aye.
Representative Agbaje, aye. Representative Robbins.
No.
Representative Robbins, no. Representative Akam.
Aye.
Representative Akam, aye. Representative Baker.
No.
Representative Baker, no. Representative Bierman.
Aye.
Representative Bierman, aye. Representative Gomez.
Aye.
Representative Gomez, aye. Representative Heintzman.
No.
Representative Heintzman, no. Representative Igo.
No.
Representative Igo, no. Representative Cleavorn.
Cleavorn, aye.
Representative Cleavorn, aye. Representative Cagle.
Aye.
Representative Cagle, aye. Representative Gattisi-Watoon.
Aye.
Representative Gattisi-Watoon, aye. Representative Kosnick. Representative Kosnick, no. Representative Kreisha.
No.
Representative Kreisha, no. Representative Lilly.
Aye.
Representative Lilly, aye. Representative Moeller.
Aye.
Representative Moeller, aye. Representative Nash.
No.
Representative Nash, no. Representative Knorr.
Knorr, yes.
Representative Knorr, aye. Representative Novotny.
Novotny, no.
Representative Novotny, no. Representative Pinto.
Aye.
Representative Pinto, aye. Representative Rarick.
No.
Representative Rarick, no. Representative Schumacher.
Schumacher, no.
Representative Schumacher, no. Representative Scott.
Scott, no.
Representative Scott, no. Representative Spudzinski.
No.
Representative Spudzinski, no. Representative Vang.
Aye.
Representative Vang, aye. Representative West.
No.
Representative West, no. Representative Joachim.
Yes.
Representative Joachim, yes. Mr. Chair, there are 14 ayes and 14 nays.
With 14 ayes and 14 nays, the motion does not prevail. The amendment is not adopted. Members, we have about 7 minutes left for discussion. Discussion to the bill.
Seeing none.
Seeing no discussion, I think we will give closing comments before we adopt the DE and vote on the bill. So closing comments, Chair Kreisha.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members. Members, again, the three parameters that we had for this was the repeal of 2028 for the UI. We had the $40 million target for READ Act and then a zero-based budget. And this bill does give local control, funding flexibility, and start to help schools. And there's a lot in here that should be celebrated and moved forward into conference committee and defended. And I hope that we can get your support so we can do that and keep the spirit of the agreement that was handed to us.
Chair Joachim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just another clarification, I forgot to mention too, stopping UI in 28 does not save us any money except for the money we put in the SPED formula in the base, but that doesn't happen until after the tails. So turning this off or saying we're going to turn it off is not saving us anything right now. I am really proud of the work that Chair Kreisha and I did. And he's right, we had the targets, and then we had a request from leadership because we were stuck. If we could have gotten unstuck by ourselves, we probably would have. Still disappointed that UI ended up being a provision that is going to be removed from some of our most dedicated hourly workers in our schools. And when I go in, and when we go into conference, I want us to be a strong team, which will be pushing for all the rest of the parts of the bill except for that one. So thank you, members.
All right, no further discussion on the DE3 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say no.
No.
No. The motion prevails and the DE3 amendment is adopted. There being no further discussion on House File 2433, Chair Joachim renews her motion to recommend House File 2433 as amended be placed on the general register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say no.
No.
The motion prevails, and House File 2433 is recommended to be placed on the general register. Chair Torkelson, any comments here at the close of the meeting? Seeing none, our agenda is concluded, and the meeting is adjourned.